So, appearance and reality, that is the subject of discussion today. And at the outset, it is good to ask the question, what is the necessity of knowing the difference? Why is it important for us to know the difference between reality and appearance? One line of thought is that if we are to progress along any path, then this distinction between appearance and reality is of paramount importance. It lies at the very foundation of any true progress. Success in any field depends on this clear comprehension of what is appearance, what is a phenomena, and what is the underlying thing, the noumena. We can understand this in terms of medical science, for example. A particular symptom appears on the body of the patient. He should be diagnosed with the correct disease. The root cause of the disease should be apprehended by the doctor. If the doctor spends his time in only treating the symptoms, if the doctor spends his time only with giving medicine to cure the symptom of the disease, then the patient is not cured. Only the symptom is touched upon, but the root cause of the problem remains and it will proliferate and give more and more problems to the patient. So, correct diagnosis means apprehending the reality by going beyond the appearance. That is one thing. Next, for example, in astronomy, when we stand here on Earth and observe things, it appears that this is the center of the Earth. This is the center of the point of observation is the center around which everything revolves. But we know that Earth itself revolves around the Sun. Though it appears that sun rises in the east and sets in the west, we know that it is only an appearance, but the reality is something else. Even in case of architecture, for this building to be built, a sure foundation must be laid. What we see here is based on and rests upon a true and solid foundation. Though foundation is not what we see, that is kind of reality on which the whole thing is built. So these are just a few examples by which we can understand that in any field, medical science, computer science, wherever you look to, going beyond appearance and touching the essence of the subject or the topic is of paramount importance. So if that is the case with all the other things which human mind dwells upon, for example, astronomy, architecture, etc., how important must it be that the man should be able to distinguish between appearance and reality with regard to himself? It is of supreme importance. It becomes of supreme importance that man knows what is real with respect to himself and what is merely appearance. Because the ideas that we hold, the feelings that we generate due to the prime fundamental ideas that we hold, has a profound effect on our life now and also upon our future. In the very beginning of his teachings in Dhammapada, Buddha lays down the primary rule which he says thus, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. All that we are is founded on our thoughts and formed of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain pursues him as the wheel of the wagon follows the hoof of the ox that draws it. If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness pursues him like his own shadow that never leaves him. So our basic ideas that we hold regarding ourselves and everything around us shapes our future, brings to us suffering or sorrow or pain and or happiness and peace. So the ideas we hold are of supreme importance. And in the same verse, we can also observe how Buddha is drawing our attention to the fact that our happiness and our suffering lies in our own hands, in the ideas that we hold and in the way of life that we lead based on those ideas. So that being said, what is meant by real and unreal? What is meant by appearance? What is meant by real? We all have some kind of vague idea as to what might be real and what we would term as appearance. Let us see what the dictionary says regarding this. Real. Real means being or occurring in fact or actuality. It means having verifiable existence. Mind you, having verifiable existence. It means true and actual, not imaginary. It is not imaginary, but true and actual. That is what the dictionary says about what is real. And as to appearance, it says it is an outward aspect. An outward aspect, something that appears, a phenomena, a superficial aspect, a semblance. Let's keep these definitions in mind and we'll use it as and when we proceed further. So this being said about what the dictionary speaks about real and appearance, let us try to first define what we mean by real. For us to term anything as real, should it not be unchanging? Take any object. If it changes from one thing to another, would you call it real? It appeared as a particular object, but it became another thing. It is not real, it is an appearance. So for something to be real, it should be unchanging. And it should be unchangeable, unmodifiable. If in this circumstance it is unchanging, you put it in another circumstance, it changes into something else. If you consider such a object or a substance or a material, then that is not real. Because only in this condition it is true, in another condition it becomes something else. Yes, yes, yes. We'll come to that. So the third thing is, it should be without beginning and end. If something comes into birth and ends at a particular point of time, which means it is limited in time, then we cannot call it as real, as to be persisting, as to be firm, as to be eternal. And neither should it be limited by space. So these are some few ideas we can hold regarding what is real, some kind of definition for real. And its opposite, we can say, is an appearance, is a unreal, is a phenomena, which is anything that is transient, anything that is changeable, anything which is born and dies and limited in space is from that high standpoint is unreal, because it is not persisting. It changes, it becomes something else. Now, against this definition of real and unreal, if we let us weigh everything else, let us examine other everything else against this definition, and it is kind of astonishing as to see that most of the things that we run after, most of the things that we try to hold on to and strive after, are all transient things. For example, any external object, any seen thing, a car for example, is it unchanging? Is it unchangeable? Or is it there forever? Is it permanent? Or does it change into something else? Is it unlimited? Is it infinite? Or is it finite? And the moment we say something is finite, it means that it was born sometime and it would have an end sometime. Similarly, the same logic can be applied to everything else, and we can examine things with this perspective and try to see what is real and what is unreal. There is an interesting story, a historical incident which happened during 4th century BC, and it is said that this is one of the first incidents of interaction between the Greeks and the Buddhist philosophers. It is said that King Milinda of Bactria visited India, and King Milinda is prides himself to be a great soldier who is able to know completely about a chariot the moment he sees it. The moment he sees a chariot, he knows about it. He is so skilled and he is so talented, and he can distinguish two identical chariots because he knows it's different, even though an ordinary person may not be able to know that. So he prides himself to know everything about a chariot, and he comes in some interaction, he converses with a Buddhist chariot dismantler, one who dismantles the chariot. His name is Nagasena. So Nagasena shows King Milinda that his idea of chariot, of what he prides himself to be so knowledgeable about, only exists in the mind of King Milinda. Nagasena says that you can never distinguish, or you can never say at what point of time a chariot stops to become a vehicle and starts becoming a firewood. Firewood is something which we used to burn. So he says, see, now there are spokes in the wheel. If you remove this spoke, would you still call it a chariot? And if you remove another spoke from another wheel, would you still call it a chariot? Now, the spokes have become firewood already. And if you remove the wheel, would you still call that thing which was there as chariot? Now, if you remove the seat, what would you call that? So, he uses this kind of logic and argument and brings the point to King Milinda's mind that the idea of chariot is not out there. The idea of a vehicle is not out there. It only arises in the mind of the person. It is the mind of the person who ascribes that qualities to that thing outside and calls it a chariot, gives it a name, gives it a form. The idea of chariot is only in mind. And we can apply to today's world and say the car that we use how do you call it a car? Do you, can we really define a car? Actually, if you think, we cannot define it. What would you call it a car? What thing would you call as a car? The four wheels and something which you drive. If that is the thing, then tomorrow morning you see that the thieves have taken the four wheels and the car is resting on the bricks. Then would you still call it a car? Or if you say that, if you take the production line in which the car was made, manufactured, then at what time would you call that thing, that arrangement of things, as a car? If you say it is based on functionality, then if the spark plug is removed for cleaning, then would it stop to become a car? And when the spark plug is inserted, would it start becoming a car? If you call the steering and the movement forward, if your car doesn't start tomorrow, would you still call it a car? So this kind of analysis of the external object shows, not only regarding car or chariot or anything, regarding anything that you take, if you only put your mind and think about it, it shows that the whole thing is a mental conception. Which is why one of the schools of Buddhist philosophy speaks about appearance. Anything, this table, this chair, us, arises because of three things: the causes which produces it, the arrangement of things, and the third and most important thing, the mind of the observer. Unless the mind of the observer is put upon the phenomena does not exist. This is what even quantum mechanics is reaching. This is the conclusion which it is reaching. So if this is true regarding the physical things which we call as, which we are so enamored by, let us think about our emotional nature. Let us think about our intellectual pursuits. For example, social status, our ambition to be looked upon as something, as someone who is worthy to be looked upon, somebody whom everybody likes to be loved. Likes to love, someone who has great social status. Forget about physical things. Even if you take the argument to the next plane of emotional and intellectual pursuits, we find that all that we run after are only shadows, not realities. They are only shadows which we are running after. We put our hope and our happiness on some emotional or intellectual pursuit, and then let us look back at our own experience and we will find this to be true. When we have this pursuit, what happens is, either we will not reach that, that is one thing, we will not gain our object of satisfaction, that is one thing, or what happens is, we will reach it, but in our very own hands, when we have it in our very own hands, it turns into something else. We find that if such and such a thing happens, if I am in such and such a circumstance, then I will be happy. But we find that either we will not have that circumstance in our life, or if we reach that particular circumstance, it would have turned into something else. The very object of happiness which we searched for becomes a source of pain, becomes a source of anguish, becomes a source of worry, of anxiety. Pain comes and touches the person finally. So this is something which each and every person invariably goes through. Invariably all of us would have some experience which, if we carefully look back and see, we find that nature is teaching us this fruit. Teaching us this this particular lesson, that there is nothing substantial that you can hold on to and say that this is what will give me happiness. It changes into something else. As our friend was telling, change is the real thing. It changes into something else. So this is what was called as the Dead Sea fruit. Dead Sea fruit referred to a very, very attractive, very full of juice, colorful fruit that is there. And after all the pursuit, you go and finally reach that fruit and pluck it from the tree and put it in your mouth and bite it. At that moment of biting, it turns into ashes. It turns into dust. So this is the allurement that is there in the human mind towards external objects and even towards other internal objects such as our emotional satisfaction, our intellectual satisfaction, etc. Individual perspective, yes, individual perspective. So let us see what let us read what the glossary says about this trick, about this kind of entrapment that happens to all of us. This is what is called as Maya. What is Maya? Maya is illusion. The cosmic power, mind you, it is a cosmic power. It is a power which enters all finite things. All finite things have that power. The cosmic power which renders phenomenal existence and the perceptions thereof possible. The very fact that we are apprehending all these things and having our own liking and disliking shows that we are completely drowned in Maya. Illusion. Illusion. In Hindu,
appearance is illusion.
That's what it says. That's what it says. Let's see further what it says. In Hindu philosophy, that alone which is changeless and eternal is called reality. Mind you, this is the definition which we were referring to. That alone which is eternal and changeless is reality. All that which is subject to change through decay and differentiation, and which has therefore a beginning and an end, is regarded as Maya, illusion. So this is the definition that the great sages have given, and it is good for us to keep this in mind when we are dealing with things in our daily life. So why do we pursue these shadows? Even after repeated attempts of trying to hold on to something substantial in things which are inherently unsubstantial, why do we try to do this? Why do we repeatedly run after things which we know are mirages? Why do we do that? The primary reason is because we are unaware of what is truly real. We are confused between what is real, truly real, and what appears as real. Let us go back to Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, and as it has been repeatedly brought forward from this platform, this knowledge is yoga. Let us understand it. This knowledge, what he says here, is yoga. So let's go back to Patanjali's definition of ignorance. Patanjali's definition of ignorance. Let's see what he says. Ignorance is the notion that the non-eternal, the impure, the evil, and that which is not soul are severally eternal, pure, good, and soul. So, what is non-eternal, we have a notion that that is eternal. What is actually evil, we have a notion that that is pure, that is good. What is impure, we confuse it to be pure. And what is not self, we confuse it to be self. And he says, this primary and fundamental distortion in our mental conceptions is a root from which all other miseries arise. All the miseries, whatever kind, physical, circumstantial, emotional, everything arises from this basic primary misconception, which is also, we can refer to what Buddha said, that all that we are is a result of what we have thought. If what we are thinking is based on ignorance, then naturally it brings on pain. As he says, the hoof of the wagon follows the wheel of the ox that draws it. So that is about what Patanjali says about ignorance. And look at this, what he says further. He says that ignorance gives rise to further miseries, further kleshas, and such afflictions are the root of and produce results in both physical and mental actions or works, and they, being our merit or demerit, have their fruitage either in the visible state or that which is unseen. So what do we understand by this? That our physical and mental conditions are all the result of what? Are the result of our own past thoughts and feelings and actions. Nothing is lost in nature. Everything that we have done, even though we have forgotten, is stored and comes back to us. Absolutely, absolutely. Character is built by us. It doesn't come through heredity, which is what we were discussing today morning. And these mental seeds are the root from which our whole life is sprung. Our whole life of birth, death, rebirth, and constant turmoil that we go through is based on these mental seeds which we are sowing. Here we can, it is good that we can, it is good for us that we will consider one of the sutras, Vipallasa Sutra, which Buddha speaks about. Vipallasa means distortion or perversion. The perversion of the mind, how does it happen? See, he enumerates three levels of distortion of the mind. One is Sanna Vipallasa. Sanna Vipallasa is distortion of senses, distortion of perception. For example, we perceive a rope to be a snake. But when adequate conditions are changed, for example, I switch on the light, I see that, okay, that is not a snake, that is a rope. That is Sanna Vipallasa, sense distortion. Next he says the inner distortion, Chitta Vipallasa, distortion of the mind. That is the next level of distortion, wherein even after light is switched on, you tend to believe that maybe that is still a snake. The rope is still confused to be a snake. And the innermost and the most dangerous form of distortion is Ditti Vipallasa, he says. Ditti is our perspective, our view, drishti. If there is a distortion of about the fundamental ideas of life, then most disastrous. If there is a misconception deep inside our mind, as Patanjali says, as to what is pure, what is impure, what is real, what is unreal, what is eternal, what is non-eternal, what is self, what is not self, then that gives rise to all kinds of problems. And in the same thing he says, sensing no change in the ever-changing. We find that in ourselves, sensing no change in the ever-changing. We find that all this thing is constant. Everything will remain forever. It's all there for my enjoyment. So sensing no change in the ever-changing, sensing pleasure in suffering, assuming self where there is no self, sensing the ugly as the lovely, gone astray with wrong view, beings misperceive with distorted minds. So, very similar to what Patanjali says about the basic mistake, the misperception that happens deep inside our mind. So here, we all know about the cave allegory of Plato. Plato in the book The Republic gives an allegory. He speaks of a circumstance wherein there is a deep cave, and deep inside the cave, if you go and see, there is a dead end, there is a wall, and beings are chained, their hand and feet and their neck, so that they can only see the wall in front of them. Can only see the wall. They cannot turn, look around, they cannot walk back. They are chained, hand, foot and their neck. And behind them, there is a fire, a great fire that is burning. And between them and the fire, there is a wall. So, the cave, then there is a fire, then there is a wall, then there are beings who sit chained and looking at the dead end, the final wall that is there. And whenever any object moves on the wall which is there between themselves and the fire, a shadow is cast, isn't it? Whenever a person moves, whenever an animal walks on it, a shadow is cast. Shadow is cast where? They sit here behind fire, there are beings who walk there, and the shadow is cast. They cannot look back and see what is real. So the echo that comes when people walk on the wall and talk, they feel that that echo is coming from the shadows. And since right from their birth they are chained like this, they think that the shadows is the only world. For them, the shadows is the only reality. And their whole society is built around those shadows. He says they give awards to those people, those chained people. Among themselves, they have made an arrangement that he who can guess what is the next shadow that comes will be a renowned person. Everything based on shadow. The whole thing is based on shadow. Very, 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 if you read that Republic, very, very illuminating allegory that he speaks about. So this is the conditioned outward looking tendency which perceives only the shadows. The general condition of mankind, this is the general condition of mankind. Let us see what Buddha says here. Why this laughter? Why this laughter? Why this jubilation when the world is burning? Shrouded in darkness, why don't you seek for light? That is the cry of Buddha. Shrouded in dark, you are shrouded in darkness, why don't you seek for light? You are making a jubilation of the shadows that you are looking at. So, he further develops this allegory and he says, if at all one is able to unchain himself, and if he is able to remove the things which is there, if he is able to turn back and look at the fire which is and the wall that is producing the shadow, and if through supreme effort he goes out of the cave and sees the real world, he is a true philosopher. A true philosopher, he says, is one who perceives reality of things. He is not chained and he doesn't look at only shadows. And look at this. If, let's say, if such a person who has gone out and seen the real world, and it's difficult to see the real world when we are accustomed to the shadows. When we are only accustomed to seeing shadows, our eyes cannot perceive even the fire that burns behind. We have to acclimatize ourselves to even perceive the fire that burns. Forget about the sun that is shining outside. So such a person who has gone out, acclimatized himself, acquainted himself with the real objects, with real things, people who speak and not just echoes, person who has seen the real nature, if he comes back and speaks to these people who are still chained to the, chained inside the cave, such a person will be persecuted. Such a person will never be believed. Such a person will be called as a madman.
So in later the God says that one who pursues the light is become nothing in the eyes of
men. Nothing in the eyes of men. He speaks about realities. The people who are chained here are accustomed to seeing shadows. They will persecute him, saying that he is telling false things. He is misleading people. So which is why we find the great teachers, they are unable to help others because we want to see falsity. We want to see, we are wedded to this falsehood. Among thousands of mortals, a single one perhaps strives for perfection. Among those so striving, perhaps a single one knows me as I am. But among all these many who knows the Vedas in their hands and very good oratory power, that is not a sign of knowledge, that is not a sign of wisdom.
Head learning.
So, coming back to this allegory, we are all chasing shadows. That is what he tries to show us. The chained to the physical existence. Because this body is a jail in which our real self, which is ourselves, is imprisoned. We are chained to this and we perceive only outwards, not inwards. And our political theory, our economic theory, our education, our society, our relationship, everything is completely built upon perception of shadows. So the reality must be apprehended for us to know what is really good for us, what is really pure, what is really eternal, and what is really self. And again, as Buddha says, this whole world is, everything that you perceive is impermanent, anicca, and it is anatta, or not yourself. You think that your body is yourself. You think that your wife belongs to you. You think that you own your son. You think that your job is yours. So, anicca and anatta. And when we pursue anything with these ideas of anicca and anatta, it produces invariably dukkha. Anicca and anatta can produce only dukkha. And therefore, your all pursuits that you do is based on shadows, which is shunya, emptiness. And a humorous answer which Yudhishthira gives when Yaksha asks him the question, what is the most strangest thing that you see among mortals? Yaksha, the most strange thing that I find among mortals is, each and every day you find people dying. Around you, everything is dying. Yet, the strange thing is, people think they are always going to be here. They are always going to enjoy things. They are going to be here permanently. He says that is the strangest thing that he sees among mortals. And we have the glorious example of Nachiketa. Nachiketa was given a choice by Yama. What was the choice? He was given the choice of choosing sons and grandsons of 100 years and much cattle and elephants and gold and horses. Choose the great abode of the earth and for thyself live as many autumns as thou wilt. However long you want your life to be prolonging, I will give you that gift. If thou thinkest this is an equal wish, choose wealth and length of days. Be thou mighty in the world, O Nachiketas, and I make thee an enjoyer of desires. Whatsoever desires are difficult in the mortal world, ask all desires according to thy will. These beauties with their chariots and lutes, not such as these to be won by men, be waited on by them, my gifts. This is the choice that Yama gives. You take all this, don't ask me about death. Don't ask me about, which means don't ask me about what lies beyond death. But Nachiketas had already gone through this experience. He was wise enough. What did he choose? He says, tomorrow these fleeting things wear out the vigor of mortal's power. Just the very next moment, even many, many yugas is like just a moment. It will just come to an end and end in nothing. Even the whole of life is short, and thine are chariots and dance and song. All the wealth and everything finally end in death. Not by wealth can a man be satisfied. Shall we choose wealth if we have seen thee? Shall we desire life while you are the master? But the wish I choose is truly that. That is, he chooses to know what lies beyond death. He is distinguished between what is real and what is appearance. When Yama gave him the choice of choosing what appears very, very, very attractive to all of us, he chose the other thing, the eternal thing, and not the impure and evil. So, our general condition of mankind is such that our senses are soaked in sense objects and our mind is drowned in materialism. We haven't developed that discriminating power and unaware of the real and unreal. We proceed along wrong lines, and invariably that is what is bringing us pain and sorrow. Even the circumstances that come and affect us is because of the wrong thinking and action based on that wrong thinking, which is bringing about inharmonious results to us. So as in Viveka Chudamani it says, 100 Brahma Kalpas even after 100 Brahma Kalpas of doing mere external rituals and ceremonies, not an inch of progress will be done. Not an inch of progress. 100 Brahma Kalpas of this kind of living will not take you anywhere. And in another place, he says, trying to attain to satisfaction, which is there in the real self, and still clinging on to your body, is as wise as clinging on to a crocodile to cross a river. You cling to body and still want happiness is like clinging to crocodile thinking that it will take you to the other shore.
Sitting on the crocodile.
Yeah, it will rend you apart. It will tear you apart. So, the basic point here is that for true progress to happen, as it was mentioned in the beginning of the talk, discrimination between what is real and unreal is of primary importance, which is what is called as Viveka. Viveka is, the definition is Nitya Nitya Vastu Viveka, which means the discrimination between what is eternal and what is non-eternal. And how does this Viveka arise? If this is of primary importance for our life and our happiness, how to develop this? It is said Viveka arises from Vichara. Viveka arises when our waking mind is made to dwell upon the teachings of the great teachers. The great teachers are like the philosophers, the true philosophers, as the Plato says, who have unchained themselves. Through supreme effort, they have gone and seen the real world, while we, in our pursuit of shadows, are chained inside the cave. And they have given specific steps, the path of true progress, how to unchain oneself, how to turn around, how to acclimatize oneself to the fire first and then the real sun, how to go out of the cave, how to go out of this tunnel of physical existence is clearly marked out. There is no ambiguity there. So the teachings of the teachers is the first step that one has to take. In the eightfold path which the Buddha mentions, what is the first step? Samyak darshana, which is right view, right perspective. Drishti, the ditti vipallasa that is there within us should be cured. The disease within us which gives rise to all the outward disease and the great disease of birth and death, bhavaroga. To cure that, the inner is where we should start. Perspective, the right perspective. And the knowledge of one's real nature as being eternal, as being unchanging. Is it not significant that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna begins his teachings with this primary distinction that your body is not yourself. Yourself is something which was neither born, you are neither going to die, fire will not burn you, wind will not dry you, water will not wet you, weapons cannot cut you. Isn't it significant to note that he is laying the foundation of the whole philosophy upon this primary idea of self being unmodifiable? So, that is what has to be acquired. That comes from study and reflection and shaping our life based on that knowledge. In the choices that we make, do we behave as if we are this body? Do we run after transient things? Or do we use viveka and choose between the Shreyo Marga and the Priyo Marga? It is this viveka which arises from vichara that gives rise to vairagya. And these three are the primary steps after which is necessary for pursuit of true knowledge, true happiness. In our pursuit of shadows, which we were discussing now, in our pursuit of unsubstantial things, in our confusion of unsubstantial to be substantial, what does it give rise to? It gives rise to demonoical qualities. Demonoical qualities arise from this confusion, this mistaking of unreal to be real. The mind is a great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer. How do you slay the mind? Not a physical object to be slayed. You slay the modifications created by the mind by understanding that you are none of this. That you are something who is the observer of the mind itself, who has divine virtues within oneself. And the mind must be trained, and therefore the body must be changed such that these divine qualities are able to, these divine virtues are able to express itself from us. If we don't do that, demonoical qualities will arise in us. What is the demonoical qualities? How does one who is full of demonoical disposition think? Krishna says, those who are born with demonoical disposition know not the nature of action nor of cessation from action. When to act, when not to act, what is action, what is inaction? They know not purity nor right behavior. They possess no truthfulness. They deny that the universe has any truth in it, saying that it is not governed by law, declaring that it has no spirit. They say creatures are produced alone through the union of the sexes and that all is for enjoyment only. Do we not find the traces of these demonoical dispositions, not few, many of them, within ourselves? Maintaining these views, their souls being ruined, their minds contracted, their natures perverted, enemies of the world. they are born to destroy. They indulge insatiable desires, are full of hypocrisy, fast fixed in false beliefs through their delusions. They indulge in unlimited reflections. Mind is constantly upon material things. What to do, how to get this, how to get this, how to avoid that, how to gain security through these means, how to avoid that pain. Convinced until death that the enjoyment of the objects of their desires is the supreme good. And look at how they think. This today hath been acquired by me, and the object of my heart I shall obtain. This wealth I have, and that also shall be mine. This foe have I already slain, and other will I forthwith vanquish. I am the Lord, I am powerful, and I am happy. I am rich and with precedence among men. Where is there another like unto me? I shall make sacrifices, give alms, and enjoy. Such is the dispositions which arise in us. If we don't allow the light of buddhi, wisdom, to shine through our minds, for it to shine, we must open the windows, we must clear the windows of our minds and open it to our divine perception, the divine self which is within us. And also it makes a very good reading to see what is godlike disposition, how do those behave who are of godlike nature, and try to develop those qualities in us. Because finally, as it is said in many places, our present condition is a outcome of what we have developed, and our future depends on what we are doing now. And nobody who is going to come and lift us and raise us to the glory of the spiritual spheres, nobody can do. If one is diseased, if another person takes a tablet, it's not going to help us. If I am diseased, I must take the tablet. I must take the medicine. So the question seems to be, is the suffering the only way by which we can learn, or is there any other way to discriminate between real and unreal? Through wisdom. If we don't take wisdom and make it a part of our life, suffering definitely comes. You know why? Because nature is kind to us. Because nature is kind to us, it brings back the disharmonious things that we have done back to us, saying that if you behave this way, this is what will happen. If you think like this, this is what will happen. It brings effects of our causes so that the soul may learn through that. But it is not necessary that we always learn through suffering. It is not necessary.